Good day, and welcome to the Common Cause Gerrymandering and the First Amendment conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Katie Phillips from Common Cause. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks everyone for joining the Common Cause briefing call on the historic gerrymandering cases that are scheduled for oral arguments at the Supreme Court on March 26th. Today we're going to get an overview of Rucho v. Common Cause, which challenges a Republican gerrymander in North Carolina. And we're going to dig into how partisan gerrymandering violates the First Amendment. And we're going to hear from a voter who, because of gerrymandering, has never voted in a congressional race under a fair map. I'm going to do a really quick round of introductions. Each of our guests will speak for about 5 minutes, and then we'll take your questions. In order to ask a question, you need to press star one, and we'll put you in the queue. So our guests today will be Kathy Fung, the National Redistricting Director at Common Cause, which is the lead plaintiff appellee in the case challenging the North Carolina gerrymandering map. Redistricting has been at the heart of Kathy's work for more than a decade. She's an expert on our cases and the architect of the California Citizens Redistricting Commission, which is the gold standard in citizen-led redistricting. We will hear from Daniel Takagi, one of our nation's leading election and First Amendment law professors at The Ohio State University and a filer of an amici brief in Rucho v. Common Cause. We had about 30 amici briefs filed this week, or end of last week, from academics like Professor Takagi and also from 40 current and former congressmen and women, 20 states, 2 Republican governors, including Arnold Schwarzenegger, and organizations like the NAACP, ACLU, and AJC. So we're in pretty good company. And our last guest is Love Caesar. She is a democracy fellow at Common Cause North Carolina and a student at North Carolina A&T University, which is the largest historically black university in our nation. Its campus is in Greensboro, and they are victims of gerrymandering. Love has never voted under a fair congressional map. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to Kathy to give us an overview.
Thanks so much. Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy Fung, and I am the National Redistricting Director of Common Cause. 10 years ago, I was the architect of California's initiative to construct a new framework for redistricting, one that was based on fairness, transparency, and citizen participation. Unfortunately, most states don't have an initiative process, and they have to rely on their state legislatures to draw their own lines. Often, that power to draw the lines is even more concentrated because it rests in the hands of a few people from one party. North Carolina is a prime example of how ugly gerrymandering can get when the system is set up to allow politicians to manipulate the district lines for partisan advantage with no apparent accountability to the people. The case before the Supreme Court, Rucho v. Common Cause, and its consolidated case, Rucho v. Legal Woman Voters of North Carolina, has presented a set of undisputed facts to the court. Interestingly, the facts are undisputed because the North Carolina party leaders believe that they are allowed to engage in partisan manipulation of the lines with impunity. So let's go through those facts. First, the party leaders and the legislature said out loud in hearing and through their votes on the principles by which they were going to adopt maps that they were drawing the most recent version of congressional district lines with the specific intent of maximizing their partisan gain. And no other reason. I should mention that the North Carolina Democratic Party is also a plaintiff in this case because they are asserting associational harms, including challenges that they have been fundraising, trying to fundraise, mobilize, and recruit quality candidates, but they're just unable to because the districts were fundamentally designed to hand a victory over to the other party. Following me, Professor Dan Takagi will be talking about how these set of facts should trigger a First Amendment protection that will be considered in this case. The second set of undisputed facts are that North Carolina's population is fairly evenly split between Republican and Democratic voters. But the party leaders drew the lines to give Republicans control of 10 congressional seats and Democrats only 3. They achieved a skewed partisan result by packing Democrats into 3 districts and then cutting up the remaining Democratic clusters of voters in North Carolina into Republican-leaning districts. The dilution happened in Greensboro, Fayetteville, and Asheville. The Common Cause case has plaintiffs from every district in North Carolina and who will be able to assert that they suffered injury from the packing or the cracking. On today's call, Love Caesar will talk specifically about how the splitting of Greensboro and her university campus, North Carolina A&T, has real-life consequences. Additionally, our case presents a series of statistical analyses by experts who will show that after running simulated maps, some 24,000 in all, that it's nearly impossible to achieve the result that the Republican leaders did in creating maps that were skewed 10 to 3 for one party or the other. It really takes an intent to manipulate those lines in order to get that kind of result. These are all examples of how there's both an impact, how the intent was clear, and how ultimately this case represents one of the extreme examples of partisan gerrymandering that, when presented to the Supreme Court, need to be found unconstitutional. Otherwise, we are essentially sending a green light signal to partisan drawers and legislatures around the country that they can have a free-for-all when it comes to drawing those lines. The North Carolina case is the best test case to right the wrongs in North Carolina and, frankly, to set a standard throughout the country. Paired with the Maryland case, which is an example of Democratic gerrymandering, we believe that this is the moment for SCOTUS to clearly articulate a partisan gerrymandering that is unconstitutional. And with that, I hand the microphone, virtual microphone, over to Dan Takagi.
Thanks so much, Kathy. As Kathy mentioned, I'm an amicus in the case, actually in both the North Carolina case as well as the Maryland case, the Lamone versus Benesec case, joined by 10 other law professors, professors of the First Amendment and election law. And Kathy asked me to speak about the First Amendment association theory that we've advanced in our brief and that the parties in both of these cases, albeit in somewhat different ways, have advanced in their briefing before the Supreme Court. Talking about why I think this is the best argument and one that we very much hope the Supreme Court will agree with for striking down the most extreme partisan gerrymanders as unconstitutional. Those of you who have been following this area over the years will recall that way back in Veith versus Jubilierer decided almost 15 years ago, Justice Kennedy had written a concurring opinion suggesting that the First Amendment might actually provide a more appropriate basis for adjudicating claims of partisan gerrymandering than the Equal Protection Clause under which claims had mostly been litigated up until that point. And Justice Kennedy, in his opinion in Veith, focused especially on the fact that voting can be one of the means through which we associate with like-minded other voters, with candidates of our choice, and with political parties, citing various cases in which the court had previously recognized voting as a form of protected expressive association under the First Amendment. And if we go even further back, there are cases arising out of my state of Ohio in which the act of voting, and in particular restrictions that had been placed on access to the ballot in the Williams and Anderson versus Celebrezzi cases, had been considered violations of the First Amendment right of association, which is really an outgrowth of the freedom of speech. Justice Kagan, last term, in her concurring opinion in Gill versus Whitford, took up this idea that voting might be considered a protected form of association and that extreme partisan gerrymanders might be deemed a violation of the right of association. And in her opinion, which was joined by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor, she actually took things one step further, suggesting that it's not only the effect on who gets elected to office that courts should consider in First Amendment association cases, but also effects on the disfavored political party and its supporters outside of the electoral process. And in particular, Justice Kagan in her Gill versus Whitford concurrence suggested that courts consider how members of the disfavored party in a state are, quote, deprived of their natural political strength by partisan gerrymandering, including difficulties fundraising, registering voters, attracting volunteers, generating support from independents, and recruiting candidates to run for office, not to mention eventually accomplishing their policy objectives, unquote. And what's interesting about both of the North Carolina and Maryland cases, and why I think these cases present in some ways the strongest partisan gerrymandering claims that have been made to date, is that in both cases we see the plaintiffs presenting evidence not only about the effect of partisan gerrymandering within the electoral process, but also evidence concerning the downstream effects of partisan gerrymandering of the type that Justice Kagan suggested. And you've heard a bit of that kind of evidence from Kathy. You may hear more from Love. But in the North Carolina case in particular, we of course have the statewide evidence of how Democrats and their supporters were disadvantaged. You know, we have the seats vote curve, the efficiency gap, mean median differences, that kind of statistical evidence. We have the simulations that Kathy mentioned. But there's also evidence about how communities have been packed and cracked, and evidence of how the party as a whole has suffered in terms of its ability to attract voters and candidates as a result of the partisan gerrymandering. Evidence, in fact, that it was uncontested in the district court. For example, there was testimony about people not coming out to vote because of partisan gerrymandering. Evidence of how Democrats and the party in the state of North Carolina were having more difficulty raising money. And there's similar evidence in the Maryland case, too, albeit the opposite party that's affected. There was a 7-1 split in the state's congressional delegation, with Democrats having 7 of the state's congressional seats, Republicans just 1. And this was the result of a dramatic change, as those of you who are on the call probably know, of one district in particular, the 6th Congressional District. And there was testimony in that case about a decline in the number of voters who were participating, as well as difficulty in raising money. So we'll see what the Supreme Court says, of course. But I think that for three reasons, a First Amendment association argument of the type that the parties have made and the type that my fellow amici law professors and I have raised in our brief is the strongest. I should emphasize that although I was introduced as a member of the faculty of the Ohio State University Morris College of Law, which I am, like all of the professors on the brief, we're simply doing this in our own capacity, and our institutional affiliation should not be misunderstood as endorsement by those institutions. But three reasons why I think this is the strongest legal basis on which to strike down the most extreme partisan gerrymanders. First, because there's over 50 years of Supreme Court precedent holding not only that the right of association is protected, but that voting can sometimes be considered a form of association. Second, because it best captures the kind of injury that's inflicted by partisan gerrymandering, which is a systemic injury that a group of people suffer by virtue of an impediment to their joining their voices with like-minded others. And third, because it provides an appropriately nuanced standard. We don't claim, and the parties don't claim, that any time there's some degree of partisan intent, a plan is necessarily unconstitutional. Rather, the standard that we as amici in this case call for is one that would allow the state to present its reasons for a plan that seems to have partisan effects. And if, for example, the plan can be justified by virtue of geographical features of the state, by the interest in keeping the districts compact, well, that would be a sufficiently compelling government interest that could, at least in some cases, if narrowly tailored, justify some burdens on the minority party. So the association test doesn't have what I would take to be a negative effect of saying that any plan with some degree of partisan effect or even some degree of partisan intent is necessarily unconstitutional. It provides an appropriately nuanced standard. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Happy to answer any questions, of course, afterwards. But for now, turn things over to Love.
Thank you, Dan. Hi, everybody. My name is Love Caesar. I am a junior at North Carolina A&T. I'm majoring in history and political science. And this is my second year as a fellow for Common Cause. So I've been immersed in this Rucho v. Common Cause case since essentially its beginning. So, of course, I knew what gerrymandering was coming into college, but I do know that a lot of people who may not have taken a government class in high school wouldn't know what that word means. So on campus, a lot of students, unless informed by either a faculty member, some type of news outlet, or one of their own colleagues, most students would be unaware of what's going on campus. And I would say that because the district line is going straight down our campus, dividing it right in half, I can talk about that for a second, actually. The line goes right down Laurel Street next to the library. On one side, you have the clock tower, some dorms, the student center, and the health center, the alumni center. And then on the other side of the line, District 13, you have the CAF, more dorms, more classroom buildings. And if you go to the campus, it looks like a normal campus, of course. You would never assume that there's a line going straight down the middle, a congressional district line going right down the middle. But we have been... Me and some student leaders on campus have been trying to spread awareness about what's going on since my sophomore year. That was when I first got involved with Common Cause. My sophomore year, my fellow and myself, we went onto the concrete around campus, around the highly populated areas, and we just got some chalk and we wrote some informative messages about gerrymandering, just things to get people interested and people asking questions about what's going on. So we would write, do you know what gerrymandering is? Do you know what district you live in? Are the maps fairly drawn? Something like that. We would write those things just so the next day when people would walk past it and they would have questions, it would be easier for us to answer them because they were already interested. We didn't have to get them interested. They would be interested by the interesting chalk that was on the ground. So we did that just so students would know what's going on. And once students learn what's happening, it's honestly very disheartening for us to know that as the largest HBCU in America, they have found fit to disenfranchise us basically by splitting us into two red congressional districts. 12,000 plus majority-minority students in one location carries a lot of weight in the electoral process, and it was clear that the state legislature knew that because there's no other college in this country divided straight into two congressional districts, especially right down the middle, so blatantly clear how it's done. There's no other college like that in America where it's done, and of course, the United States has a history of taking the black vote and suppressing it. So it's clear how this gerrymandering itself dilutes the people power at A&T, and it's very difficult to keep up. I know some students who aren't as physically engaged say that it's hard to keep up with who's representing us, and it's also for myself to increase civic engagement because of that confusion that students face. So I do know that opposing in North Carolina, anyone who opposes Republicans, these gerrymandered maps are intentionally diluting our vote. And it's, as I said, very disheartening to hear and to try and fight against because, you know, as a student, I don't have a direct hand specifically in this court case process with the Supreme Court, or even when it started on the local level. I am basically brought the information, you know, I take it to my peers, and we storm some solutions, how to get the word out, how to make people more aware of what's going on. But ultimately, it comes down to students not thinking that their vote counts because of the fact that it essentially doesn't. If we're 5,000 minority students in a packed into a district of Republicans, we know that our votes have less weight, significantly less weight than they would have if we were in fair congressional districts that didn't look like the Black community was broken up into districts. It doesn't, fair maps don't look like that. And now at A&T, we've been on this fight ever since 2016. And that was the first year that I could vote in any type of election. 2016 was my first year voting. And of course, it was already, the maps were unconstitutionally drawn, but I had to go ahead and vote in that election. And every election I voted in since then has been on a gerrymandered map because of the fact that even when the local courts struck down the drawn maps, we were not given maps. The new maps that were drawn were still unconstitutional, and we were made to vote using those maps. So I'm 20 years old, and I'm not sure how many elections I've voted in. I think it's been three elections so far, and they've all been on these gerrymandered maps. And I do find that very offensive, not just for myself, but also for some of my peers and colleagues who are older than me. They also have been voting in these maps since they were old enough to vote. It's hard to look down on voter apathy when that person has good reasoning behind why they don't want to vote, like the fact that their vote is essentially not, it doesn't count, not when one of their votes is outnumbered by 15 on election day. So I do think that it's important for the Supreme Court, when they hear this case on the 26th, for them to set a precedent for how this type of partisan gerrymandering, about how unconstitutional it is, and it's setting an example to us who are future leaders of this country, setting an example to us about how they want us to act when it comes to things like this. Will they act with integrity and strike down unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering, because that's what this is, and it's affecting us. It's been affecting us for years. I would really, really love to vote on a constitutional district, congressional district map. That would be awesome. And, you know, I would just say that I don't want the Republicans to gerrymander the congressional district lines for Democrats, and I don't want Democrats to do that for Republicans. You know, Common Cause is a nonpartisan organization. And so we do think that gerrymandering as a whole cheats voters out of our representation. And as this case continues on to the Supreme Court, I have very, very high expectations that the Supreme Court would rule against gerrymandering. For now, that's all I have to say. I have to take questions. Whenever is the time. I'll just turn it back over to Katie.
Thanks, love. Christina, do you want to explain how we'll do questions?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. And again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question. Take our first question. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Mark Sherman with AP. Thanks for doing the call. I had a couple of quick questions. Dan, you said that the cases this time were the strongest partisan gerrymandering claims. I seem to recall the similar language last year in the Wisconsin case. And, of course, that points up the fact at that point you didn't have in the end, Justice Kennedy was not willing to go where the four more liberal justices went. Why should we expect there'd be a fifth vote this year when there wasn't one last year?
Yeah. So that's the million-dollar question that I think everyone is asking. And you sometimes see this in the law. Look, we've been at this now for, if you want to go back to Davis versus Bandemir, now 33 years. And I think the first answer to your question is that over the course of that period of time, things just keep getting worse and worse. And the information about how sophisticated the parties have gotten becomes clearer and clearer. And responding to the point about what's different implicitly, at least, what's different about these cases from the ones that came before, I think the big difference is we've now got this evidence of effects on the parties outside of the electoral process, which wasn't present in the Gill versus Whitford case. We've also, on the standing point, got more direct evidence of the harm to individuals and groups. We've got the North Carolina Democratic Party actually as a party this time around. So there are these differences. But to me, the biggest reason for being hopeful here, we don't know for sure what the court is going to do, is that the evidence about how bad the problem has gotten and how toxic it is for our politics as a whole becomes clearer and clearer over time. And this isn't a problem that's going to fix itself. So the fact that nobody in the last set of cases said definitively that they think these extreme partisan gerrymanders are unconstitutional, although the four concurring justices did pretty strongly suggest that they think there is a basis in the First Amendment right of association for striking extreme partisan gerrymanders down. But none of them went all the way towards saying that. The fact that the other five weren't ready at that point to go along, I don't take to mean that they never will. We just don't know. And among that group, Justice Thomas is the only one who's really been on record since he was around last decade when the LULAC case was decided, as saying that he thinks this is a non-justiciable political question. Even he, I suppose, could change his mind. But we really don't know where the other four stand. And, you know, I recall Chief Justice Roberts' gobbledygook comment in the last oral argument in the Gill versus Whitford case. But I think it's really tempting and easy to read too much into those kinds of remarks. What I took him to be suggesting is that statistical evidence alone doesn't suffice to show that a particular plan or district is unconstitutional. I agree with that basic proposition, and I think there's more evidence in this case than we've had in the prior partisan gerrymandering cases, especially the North Carolina case where the evidence on statewide effects is so strong.
Hi, this is Kathy. I'll just jump in and say that, you know, this is one of those unique situations where the the lead up to how we got here is also important to know. So North Carolina had been sued over the course of a decade, first on challenges to the maps that were drawn in 2011 as racial gerrymanders. And the court found definitively that there had been racial gerrymandering and ordered the legislature to redraw the lines mid-decade. In doing so, the state legislature said, okay, we'll redraw those lines. And this time we will use the data that we have available, and the only thing that we're going to be thinking about is partisan advantage. They say it out loud. They pass it as law, as the principles, the guiding principles by which they were going to adopt the maps, and then they ultimately adopted the maps. And what we think is that that very clear admission that that was their intent puts this case in a different category than other instances where maybe the legislature is just a little bit more subtle about what they do. When there is a clear admission as to what they're trying to do, it perhaps makes it a much more black and white case for the Supreme Court to say, okay, when you have this kind of intent, when we don't have to question it because it is not only said by the leaders but adopted into law, then is that permissible? And we saw this line of questioning coming from the Supreme Court last round when they said, so what happens if it's – what happens when the law actually says we're going to put our finger on the scale and skew this one way or the other? And even, you know, the state legislature on the other side had to admit, yeah, if that's the case, then, yeah, that should be unconstitutional. We can't say that where the court will draw the line for other instances where you have to rely on circumstantial evidence or, you know, less clear evidence, but in the North Carolina case, there is just such an overwhelming amount of evidence on the record that that was the legislature's intent when they drew these lines, that we think that at least when you've got an admission note, that ought to be an instance when we say that's not allowed. You can't get away with it when you're clear that your intent was to skew the lines.
Thank you.
And just as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. Again, that's star 1 to ask a question. It appears there are no further questions at this time.
Great. Then we're going to wrap it up. Thanks, everybody, for joining. We really appreciated you joining the call. Keep an eye out for an email from me with a link to the audio. And we will have a third and final briefing call on the 20th with our legal team. So also stay tuned for an invite to that. It'll be a chance to connect with Emmett Bondurant and some of our lawyers directly before the case.
And if folks have any follow-up questions and you were just struggling to manage your star one or, or it just comes up as you're writing the article, please feel free to email Katie Phillips at kphillips@commoncause.org.
That's right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.